Hi, I'm Mac.
Hi, I'm Abigail.
And this is Unsubs.
This is the podcast where we recap, rate, and review all 324 episodes of Criminal Minds. Today we're talking season 6, episode 3, Remembrance of Things Past.
I still can't believe we're back, bitch.
We are back, bitch. I need you guys to know that I wrote this recap on July 27th, and we are recording it on September 4th.
My birthday is so soon.
Yes, I'm so hyped about your birthday. And my birthday's soon, too.
Yes.
So a couple new housekeeping things and little alerts that we're going to be doing before we even get into anything, because I don't want to forget. We are, one, going to be doing an unsub is a white man with brown hair alert. So it's going to sound like this.
I think not.
Remember what we were talking about last episode, when Kat was filling us in on all of this information that I didn't know, and I don't think Abigail knew about what the Criminal Minds writers did to Prentice and JJ, so those two actresses. So what we will be doing at the end of every episode, hopefully I remember, is we are going to be using a clip from the Saturday Night Live sketch Papyrus. If y'all are not familiar with this clip, it is my favorite. I would say it's one of my favorite Saturday Night Live sketches, in which Ryan Gosling realizes that the motion picture Avatar used the font Papyrus instead of like creating their own font.
Yeah, he just highlighted Avatar. He clicked the drop down menu and then he just randomly selected Papyrus like a thoughtless child just wandering by a garden, just yanking leaves along the way.
You know what you did? I know what you did!
That encompasses how we feel about how the writers treated these two actresses.
Mm-hmm.
And we do realize that the actresses come back and things are made somewhat right. But we just want to do, as a reminder, we want to mention this and we want to bring attention to it because it was really shitty what they did. And we will not forget what they did.
I know what you did!
I have a fun fact.
Go ahead. I forgot I needed another one for this recording session.
Yes. I just want to say that I have been trying to get people to watch F-Boy Island. And if you haven't watched it, I would appreciate if you, the listener, did, because I want them to make more. I do feel that it is somewhat of a feminist masterpiece. I know that's kind of a crazy thing to say. And there, you know, it's not body diversity and it's not the most intelligent thing in the world. But I do really appreciate the show. And I love trash TV. I love 90 Day Fiancé. I love Love is Blind. But my favorite romance dating show of all time is F-Boy Island. So if you like trashy TV and you haven't watched F-Boy Island, it's got terrible reviews in IMDb, which I think is unfortunate because it does have a little bit of self-awareness about the type of show it is. And it does kind of feel like girl power and a little girl bossy, but I do like to see women working together and talking to each other and taking care of each other. In case anyone needed to know, Casey is my favorite.
Oh God, what is my fun fact? Gentle listeners, you know that I moved, and I'm not going to tell you where I moved or what school I'm going to or why I'm going to this school, because that's too much personal information. However, what I am going to say is that I live in a small town now with lots of hills. And the cool thing about the small town is that I can walk everywhere. I literally haven't gotten gas since I moved here. because I don't have to drive anywhere. However, hills everywhere, and it is such a sweaty experience. But my God, my legs and ass are going to be amazing by the end of this year. So much walking, so many hills. I was driving home from work yesterday because that's the one place I have to drive to. And I was going up a hill, and for a second, I was like, oh my God, like, what if my brakes give it? Like, this is horrifying.
Oh.
So, yeah, that may not be the most exciting fun fact, but, like, we'll keep them coming. We'll keep them coming.
Yeah, I live on, like, the highest point of a kind of, well, I live in the Hudson Valley, so, like, it's all hills everywhere.
So we had, I forget what we were calling them.
Listener thought. I don't think we figured it out.
Hiya, baby.
Hey, baby girl. We need to talk.
PG or NC-17?
You're on speakerphone.
I charge extra for groups.
So this was submitted by Avery. This was back in August, but Avery says, you guys were ahead of the curve calling out the Criminal Minds team for their flagrant private jet usage. Taylor Swift is quaking. Also, love the podcast and love your take on deep dives. I'm glad you guys focus on other topics and not similar murders. Thanks for what you do. And they also said, whenever I hear the word convoluted in my day-to-day, my brain adds your bell sound like Pavlov's dog.
I love that so much. I have to say it was super cool to do our trivia with people who, like, actually listen to our podcast. Because a lot of the times it's like, oh my God, you actually listened? You heard that? So it's so cool when you guys write in. Like, we genuinely love it.
All right. You want to read the next one?
Okay. Yeah. I'm so sorry about this. Okay. This is from Angelina. And Angelina, I'm so sorry. She wrote, currently listening to season one, episode 4. And I'm so confused why you guys thought Gubler was 37 in 2005 when he was born in 1980. Yes. I don't know why I thought he was 37 either. I have no explanation. I think maybe I just saw that was his current age now, and I'm dumb. I don't know what to tell you.
Sometimes we get things wrong.
I'm so sorry. And no one has brought this up, but yeah, he was young when he started the show. But I mean, I've thought for a long time about, like, how wrong we were about things. And we did things really differently in season one. And I really hope that when people are finding our podcast for the first time, they listen to our newer episodes first or kind of do a mix. Because the first season was rough. But I think that's how it starts for everyone. So I don't really want to change it. I kind of want to just, like, leave it so you can see how far we've grown and how much more sophisticated we've come. I don't even think we had mics when we started.
I didn't.
Yeah, girl. Thank God for the Yeti. Anyways, but we really appreciate everyone who's listened from the beginning and come with us on this journey. And sorry, Angelina. And sorry, Goobs.
And the last one is just a compliment from Jacqueline. He says, what a great idea for a podcast. I'm a huge Criminal Minds fan, and I'm happy to chat about Criminal Minds anytime.
I love that. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That's so cool.
Hiya, baby.
Hey, baby girl. We need to talk.
PG or NC-17?
You're on speakerphone.
I charge extra for groups.
We're going to get into this episode. I actually really, really like this episode.
Me too.
Do you, Abigail, want to do our rating criteria? And then I'll just, like, jump into it.
Yeah. So our rating criteria, as always, each episode can get up to 100 points. Each category can get 20 points. And the categories are criminal/serial killer, character development/character arcs, forensics and context, script writing, and background characters.
We are in no way, shape, or form associated with the television show Criminal Minds. We're big fans. And let's get into remembrance of things past. We open in Bristol, Virginia, and there's a family getting into a car at night, ready to head off to a football game. We meet parents Sam and Candace DeLilly and their son, whose name is Lyle.
Bad name.
Legit think they named this child Lyle. They're going to the big game, but they can't find the tickets. So Candace goes back inside to grab the tickets from the kitchen counter. And while the doors open and she's inside, she sees that there's also like windows open in the house and it's windy and it's creepy. And she tries to turn on the living room light, but it zaps her. And it's very spooky. But she finds the tickets and Sam goes to the door and meets her. And he's like, let's go, let's go, let's go. And as they're about to walk out, the phone rings. And Candace is like, oh, it's probably our daughter, Jenny. And I'm like, so these parents really named their children Jenny and Lyle?
Mm-hmm.
I would kill my parents. I would simply kill them.
What if it's Jenny?
Call her from the car. You know your daughter. She probably just wants to talk about a new dress she bought. Come on.
Mom, Dad, this is Jenny. I'm in trouble. I'm in so much trouble. I know you taught me to not be afraid, but I'm so afraid. When you get this message, I'll probably be dead. So I just wanted to tell you that... Oh, God, please pick up the phone. Please.
Sam is like, fuck Jenny. She probably just wants to chat about a new dress she wants. Let's go see some football.
Also, is it like the early morning or is it the night? Because it's dark out.
I think it's super late at night and I think they are going to... I in my mind, it was like an indoor stadium, but that does not make sense. I have watched all of Last Chance U, and they don't have indoor stadiums, so I don't know. But it's kind of weird that it's stormy as well. I think they're just trying to build the suspense, but the storm kind of has nothing to do with what happens. As the family leaves, the voicemail message hits, and it was Jenny. And she has some alarming things to say. So we cut to Rossi's house. And I wrote that it's like a very gold-themed decor choice. He's in his study and there are bookcases with fancy books and gold curtains and a fireplace with gold statues on it. It's like, okay, we get it. He's wealthy. He's a wealthy person. He's on vacation and he's supposed to be working on his new book and he's like so bored. He's not getting it done. Writer's block is real. And Hotch calls Rossi and Rossi is so hyped and he's like, I hope you want me to come in. I almost forgot about my Rossi impersonation for a second there.
How could you?
How could I? Hotch tells Rossi that the bodies of two girls were found in Bristol, Virginia, and they were tortured and electrocuted. And Rossi asks if either girls made a phone call. Remember, we heard Jenny's terrifying phone call, and Hotch is like, yep, they both made calls, but without the signature.
What's the signature? Guess we'll find out.
Guess we'll find out. Also, torture by electrocution is so scary. I'm sorry. That's so scary. Cut to BAU headquarters in Quantico, Virginia.
Is that Ellie again?
Oh, she texts me every morning on her way to school.
How's she doing?
Well, she's already got herself a BFF named Jill, and she thinks she wants to play soccer.
She's adjusting. It's good.
Bristol, Virginia. The body of 25-year-old Jenny DeLilly was found yesterday. She had been tortured, sodomized, and electrocuted before being forced to make a goodbye call to her parents. Her body was then dumped off Eldon Street. A week ago, the body of Kara Kirkland was found in the same area, having suffered identical injuries.
This reminds me of the Butcher case.
Why does that name sound familiar to me?
The Butcher was a sexual sadist that killed 20 women in the same area of Virginia from 1984 to 1993 and then vanished. He tortured blonde women in their 20s that lived in or near Bristol.
That was one of Rossi's old cases, isn't it?
Yes. Does he know?
Some vacation. Did you get any sun?
I never got anything.
Do you think the Butcher's back?
I doubt it. I profiled him as a white male in his late 40s back then. He'd be in his 70s by now.
Didn't you almost catch him?
In the spring of 93, we narrowed the geographical profile. We alerted every blonde in their mid-20s in Bristol and the surrounding counties. The pressure got so intense, the killings just stopped.
Apparently the butcher was one of Rossi's old cases. And Rossi shows up with the files, and he is uncertain whether the butcher is really back or it's a copycat. Because they profiled the butcher being in his 40s when he was killing, which would make him in his 60s now. So we cut to the BAU private jet.
Hey, girl.
And they're talking about victimology. I just want to point out that Prentice calls the victims Vicks. We get a lot of Vicks.
Yeah, it really bothers me.
Yeah, I don't care for it. It's now very much part of the canon, and everyone is saying Vicks.
Also, this is such an unrelated point, and I apologize now, but because I looked at Matthew Gray Gubler to see his birth year, did you know he had an internship with Wes Anderson?
Can you imagine?
Right?
I can't.
Yeah, and that's why he was in The Life Aquatic.
Oh my god.
Oh my goodness. Sorry. Go on.
So, Vicks. Apparently the phone calls the Vicks make are on disposable cell phones, which can't be tracked. And we know that Jenny left a message for her parents, but apparently Kara actually spoke to her fiancé on the phone before she was killed, which is awful. The BAU talks about the previous cases from 20 years ago, and suddenly everyone is saying Vic, and I just feel like it's rude.
Rossi, were the phone calls the butcher made his victims leave similar?
Yeah, but the content varied. 13 Vicks left answering machine messages for loved ones. 5 actually talked to someone before they died, and 2 reached no one.
But didn't the butcher make his victims end their messages by saying they were enjoying it?
That was the signature.
Wouldn't that make a sadist flaccid?
It wasn't about him. It was about the parents. He wanted to make sure that they knew he had complete control and dominance over their daughters.
All right, Morgan and Prentice, go to the ME. We need to compare ritual and MO. Rossi Reed and I will interview the families and go over the messages.
Cut to Bristol, Virginia. Detective Green is the lead on the case, and he is positive that the butcher is not back and they're dealing with a copycat. Although Rossi in Quantico is like, nah, it's definitely not the butcher. He acts like he thinks it's actually the butcher to the detective. And I'm like, isn't this kind of like counterproductive?
Yeah. Weird motivations going on here.
We cut quickly to the morgue, and Morgan and Prentice talk to the Emmy, who tells us some really horrific things that happened to the girls. I'm going to try to like skimp over it. They were tortured with electric items. They were burned. They were assaulted. It is as bad as you are imagining. She also tells the BAU that the girls were likely knocked unconscious during their abduction, which is different from the smooth-talking MO of the OG butcher.
I hate to say that it like is giving Bundy, but it does remind me of like Bundy.
Yeah, I definitely think that that was like, you know, that's part of
inspiration.
Yeah, the inspo. The Emmy also notes 2 different sets of knife wounds. So the BAU was starting to suspect that they may have 2 killers working together. Cut to a man bringing groceries in from the back of a van. And there's a blonde girl named Anna who walks by and is like, hi, Colby. And I'm like, are we really like doing Colby again? Colby Jack Cheese. And she tells Colby that, I just got a job at Joe's Coffee. Come by sometime. And it's very like they've known each other for a long time and they're buddies and she really likes him. But he acts like he doesn't really know her. And it's a little like off-putting. And I'm like, okay. Colby goes, sounds good. And this romantic tete-a-tete is interrupted by Colby's elderly father, who struts out of the house and down the driveway and yells, I'm hungry, at the top of his lungs. The blonde girl quickly excuses herself, and the old man yells at Colby, who, to be clear, is his son. And the old man complains that Colby is a bad caretaker.
I had a good caretaker. He'd be here on time. I don't pay you to be late.
I'm coming.
That's what you said an hour ago. I should have got rid of you when I had a chance.
We cut back to Bristol PD headquarters, and the team interviews the Vicks families. I'm sorry. I really leaned into it. Every time they said it, I just wrote it. But that's not right. You should not be talking about victims like that. Interviews the victims' families. Hutch is meeting with the DeLilly family, and Rossi and Reed meet with Kara's fiance. They ask about the specific language that the victims used, and Reed goes, "Would you say that her lexical features are consistent with her vernacular?" And Kira's fiance, who again literally received a "I'm being murdered" call from the love of his life, is like, "What?" And Rossi clarifies, "Are the words hers?"
"Did your fiance say anything that sounded out of the ordinary?"
"No. She sounded like herself, considering the circumstances."
"You say that her lexical features are consistent with her vernacular?"
"Huh?"
"Are the words hers?"
"That's what she said."
So we cut back to the old man and Colby. And Colby has this slide projector and is quizzing the old man on different locations. And the old man does pretty good, but there are a few locations he does not recognize. And he gets really angry and confrontational with Colby. And this all culminates with him demanding that Colby take him out. Just to be clear, in case it wasn't abundantly clear, the older man in this episode, Colby's father, definitely is dealing with some sort of Alzheimer's dementia situation. He's quite elderly. He's very confused. And this plays a big part in the rest of the episode. But I just want to make this clear. Reed and Rossi listen in on some of the butcher's old tapes. And in one of the recordings, Rossi was able to digitize the butcher's voice.
"He doesn't even sound human."
"Did you transfer all the tapes yourself?"
17 years ago, he sounded like background noise. But when I digitized them, you could hear every word."
"Yes, you did. She's dead."
"It's stunningly creepy."
"I never caught the butcher, but I caught his voice. Go to bed hearing him, wake up hearing him."
"It'd be like hearing a message from Jack the Ripper. Why have you never written about him?"
"He had too much power. We need to find him first."
At this point, when we, the listener, are hearing this voice, we're like, okay, it's the old man. The old man is the butcher. And Colby, his son, it seems like he may know about his father being the butcher. Rossi and Reed listen back to the old tapes. They realize that the butcher's actually making his newer victims recite what his original victims said. For example, Jenny DeLilly's message is verbatim what the butcher's last known victim, Susan Cole, said in her goodbye message. Which is so fucking creepy and fucked up and like, oh my God, like, you are made to give a goodbye message that is not yours.
Not even your own.
Cut to somewhere in Bristol. The old man, aka the butcher, finds a blonde girl in a secluded area and he hurries over to her. And he's really like leaning into the old man confusion thing. So the fine line that they walk in this episode is he genuinely seems to have Alzheimer's or dementia. And then he's kind of like playing up the "I'm an innocent old man." And you kind of don't know what is what, but he genuinely has memory problems. So he's like, "Miss, you got to help me. My caretaker had a heart attack." And this would have gotten me, man. Like, I would have been like, oh my God, you know, like, "Little old man, let me help." Like, he looks super like innocent, which is also very, very creepy. So of course this girl hurries over, and then Colby snatches her from inside the van and knocks her out. And then we cut to the butcher's lair, and Colby and the butcher are torturing and killing this blonde girl whose name is Heather Langley. We have, I guess it's like a mini profile. I don't really know.
Rossi is, like, not paying attention to the profile, so we don't really get it.
He's like, "I already know. I worked the case, yeah."
What we get is that these unsubs are considerably organized. They most likely have some sort of secondary location that they use to torture their victims. Their skill level is evidenced by the high-risk public nature of their abductions. They're able to lure their intended victims with some kind of ruse. Then they blitz attack them with overwhelming force. We think that this is the work of two of the Butcher's fans and that they're going to strike again.
So we cut to the Butcher and Colby, and they discuss the murder of Heather Langley. And I actually, like, really love this dialogue. I'm going to put a big quote in the audio.
You're in a good mood? Wednesday was always a good day for me.
Yesterday was Tuesday.
She responded right.
I upped the volts on the charger. I think that helped.
Call went better, too. You got it to say exactly what I needed. You've never been so helpful.
That's not true.
Name one time you helped me without being told.
When I was 10.
Oh, please.
No, I helped with the woman in the hallway.
There's never a woman in the hallway.
Yes, there was. She was running.
And Colby is like, well, what about the time when I was like a child and I helped you like attack that woman in the hallway? And the Butcher's like, well, how are you going to help me today? And I'm like, oh my God. Like, someone in their life has an elderly relative and they're really doing the best on this. Colby has pictures of various blondes that they've been stalking and asks the Butcher to choose which one he wants Colby to abduct next. And the Butcher suggests Anna, who, to be fair, is not in these pictures, but she's the neighborhood girl that was like, Colby, you're so sexy.
Mm-hmm.
Colby then tells the Butcher that he's like way too close to Anna. It doesn't make sense. They can't touch her. It would be suspicious. So they decide to go after a woman who is a knife salesman. There's a long montage of the BAU doing research and running theories by one another. And this ends with Rossi showing up and he's like, the unsub pair we're looking for is a father-son duo. Rossi suggests that the Butcher groomed his son, which we know to be true.
We need to figure out why he's back, like BTK or the Grim Sleeper. Let's go over victimology one more time.
He kills blondes who are living on their own.
Takes them from public places with some form of ruse.
He's reenacting his last kill. For what reason?
Maybe there's something symbolic about the last kill. Let's hear a call again.
Hey, guys, maybe we should take a look at the victims that didn't call anybody. Think about it. There were 13 recorded messages and 5 documented conversations with loved ones.
So what?
So there were 20 kills. 2 victims didn't call anyone.
I just assumed those victims couldn't reach anyone.
Let's pull the files of the victims that didn't leave a message. Reed might be onto something.
These 2 victims are Sylvia Marks and Karen Bachner. Back with Butcher and Colby. Colby is digging a grave in the backyard. And the Butcher is hungry and his stories aren't on. And he's like clearly like not understanding, like not cognizant of what's going on. And Colby reminds the Butcher that they literally just killed the knife saleswoman yesterday. But the Butcher does not remember and tells Colby that there's no way that they had killed this woman who's in the grave that Colby is burying. And then he accuses Colby of hunting without him. And it's really sad and emotional and like a little funny. Like it's a lot of different emotions. The BAU discussed Sylvia Marks and Karen Bachner.
So Sylvia Marks was the Butcher's first kill. Karen Bachner was his 8th.
So why weren't they forced to make phone calls?
Sylvia was his first kill. He was building up his confidence.
Then he thinks to himself, how can I hurt the most people? I'll have them make calls.
And then 6 women after that made phone calls. Why did he stop at Karen?
Garcia, what are Karen Bachner's parents' names?
George and Claire Bachner died in a car accident when Karen was 19.
Now, my notes say Karen had a husband named Lee Mullins.
But he didn't receive a call.
When I interviewed him at the station, he said he didn't have an answering machine.
Did they have a child?
Negative.
Oh, wait a minute.
They had a son. I wrote it down. Colby.
Garcia, run Karen's maiden name.
Bachner.
Oh, there it is, sir. You are totally right. Karen had a son, Colby Bachner, born at Johnson Memorial in Bristol, Virginia.
Was the father there to sign the birth certificate?
Yes. His name was Lee Mullins.
Oh. Karen had a Colby 2 years before her and Lee were married.
Are the father and son still in the area?
Yeah, Lee Mullins and Colby Bachner live at 1844 Shadowwood Lane, which is 6 miles from where the victims were dumped.
So maybe Karen Bachner never made a call because the most important person in her life was already in the room with her, her son.
Oh, hells no. They're licensed electricians.
When the BAU look into it, it turns out Lee Mullins and Karen Bachner had a son together named Colby.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, Karen Bachner, the murder victim of the butcher,
is the mother.
I want to say the audacity of the parents in this episode to name their children Lyle and Colby is just so much.
Yeah, they really didn't love their kids.
So cut back to the butcher and Colby, Lee Mullins and Colby, as I should say. After their little fight, the butcher is sulking, so Colby's like, okay, I'm going to go abduct Anna, my friend Anna, you know, who just had the job at Joe's Coffee, because I don't want you to be sad. He drives to Joe's Coffee, and the BAU shows up at Lee's house, and they knock on the door, and they find Lee, aka the butcher, and he's very disoriented and running around in his boxers and a wife beater shirt. And Rossi is, like, so ready to nail him and, like, you know, get justice for these girls. And as he's, like, got the gun on Lee, Lee pisses himself because he's afraid and confused.
I can't, that, like, really,
The BAU finds the fresh grave in the backyard, and they find a note from Colby saying that he's going to go abduct a new girl. So they decide that they're going to move all the police cars out of the neighborhood so that when Colby comes back, they can just grab him. But it's too late. Colby pulls up. He's got his friend Anna from Joe's Coffee knocked out in the car. He sees the cop cars leaving, and he takes off. The BAU finds Alzheimer's medication and discusses how Colby has probably been assisting his father. So Rossi questions Lee Mullins, and I think it's really aggressive.
We met 20 years ago. Do you remember that, Mullins?
I'd like a soda with lemon, thank you.
You played the grieving husband. I was a young FBI agent. So tell me, where is your son, Mullins? Where is he taking your next victim? To a friend's place? To an abandoned house?
I rewired this house.
Did he help you with that? Or did you do that on your own?
Those are trophies.
What do you know about trophies?
I like trophies. Proves you won something.
Well, you're not going to win today.
Yeah, I was like, Rossi got really lost in the Rossi was just Rossiing and got lost in the Rossi sauce. Like, it was too much.
Yeah, and Mullins, he vacillates between being like genuinely confused and scared and asking for his son, and then remembering fragments of his time as a serial killer, which, again, knowing about Alzheimer's, like, is that's the real deal. Like, that's how people react. He tells Rossi that he's scared, and Rossi tells him that he has no right to be scared. He says something to Rossi like, you know, she freaked out when she saw the Lexwell, which we learn was used for electroshock therapy. So the BAU is like, okay, Colby is using an ECT machine in probably like an abandoned psychiatric hospital. So, of course, they find it. It's a mental hospital where the Mullins worked back in the day. And there are a few operational buildings, but the rest are abandoned. So they go over and they find Colby. Colby has kidnapped his friend Anna, and she's crying and pleading for her release. And Colby has tied her up, but it's clear that he's devolving without Lee to tell him what to do. So the BAU finds Colby inside, and he's about to start torturing Anna or Anna or whatever her name is.
I'll kill her. The killing is done.
Please help me.
This is not your fault, Colby. Your father got you into this.
No, you don't know my dad.
We know you're losing him, Colby. This isn't going to help.
He's getting better.
No, he isn't. And I know that scares you because you already lost your mother.
She left us.
Your father killed her.
No, you're wrong.
You were 10. He strapped her to this table.
My
Mom went to Boston to live with her sister.
Your father brought her here.
So he ultimately allows himself to be arrested and Anna is saved. So that's the end of that. And then we get this little moment where Prentice questions Morgan about his relationship with Ellie Spicer. And he's still involved in her life. And I think he does a good job of defending why he's staying in her life.
Oh, please don't tell me that's Ellie again.
She just wants me to say goodnight. Trust me, Prentice, I get it. But I'm the first person she wants to speak to in the morning. She won't go to bed unless she talks to me at night. The girl's got PTSD. She's got to vent to someone.
A professional.
Or someone who's been there.
And then at the very, very end, Lee Mullins tells Rossi that he does remember Rossi. And he tells Rossi that Rossi is the reason he stopped killing because he was afraid of being caught.
That moment was so intense.
Even scarier than that episode is Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I have a couple general overviews on it. So basically, like, Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia because they're not exactly, like, the same. A general term for memory loss and other cognitive abilities serious enough to interfere with daily life. Alzheimer's disease accounts for 60 to 80 of dementia cases. It's also not a normal part of aging. The greatest known risk factor is increasing age, and the majority of people with Alzheimer's are 65 or older. It also worsens over time. It's a progressive disease where dementia symptoms gradually worsen over a number of years. In its early stages, memory loss is mild, but with late-stage Alzheimer's, individuals basically lose the ability to carry on a conversation and respond to their environment. On average, a person with Alzheimer's lives 4 to 8 years after diagnosis, but can also live as long as 20 years, depending on other factors. Alzheimer's changes typically begin in the part of the brain that affects learning. As it advances through the brain, it leads to increasingly severe symptoms, including like disorientation, mood, and behavior changes, deepening confusion about events, time, and place, unfounded suspicions about family, friends, and professional caregivers, and then more serious memory loss and behavior changes, and then horrifyingly, difficulty speaking, swallowing, and walking. Currently ranked as like the 7th leading cause of death in the United States. And there's no cure.
Yeah.
But there is treatment and continuing investigation and research into therapies and treatments.
Should we rate this episode?
Yeah, let's rate this episode.
I really like this episode.
Me too. I want to give Criminal/Serial Killer a 20 just because I think it's very complex and
yes,
lots to do with that.
I love a murderer where I'm not sure how I feel about him going to jail. I'm like, you know, character development, character arcs. I thought we got a lot of really good Rossi in here. I thought we got a little Morgan in here.
Do you want to give it a 20? Do you want to give it a 15?
I don't know, like maybe a 20, because I guess at the end, Rossi gets to hear that he's the reason that this guy stopped killing all those years ago, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Forensics and context, horrifying.
Yeah, I say that's a 20 too.
Script writing?
Does this episode get a 100? Like,
I think we could give it a 100.
I don't have a lot of complaints. I think it's really, really good.
Yeah. Do you want to go? Okay, script writing. What about background characters? We didn't have tons.
Well, we had Colby, his son. I guess maybe we could take a couple points off for Colby because I don't understand the relationship with Anna. Like, she's really into him. He's acting super weird. Maybe he's distancing himself because he doesn't want her to get killed, but then he just kidnaps her. So I'm like, okay. I mean, well, you could give that an 18 and give this a 98.
Yeah, let's do 18. All right, so 98.
Well, thanks for tuning in. As always, we have a Patreon. We release episodes early. We have ad-free episodes. Your support, $5 a month, makes it possible for us to do things. And I think that if we have 30 patrons, we're able to not only pay our web fees, our hosting fees, our fees to make the content, we're also able to pay both of us $20 a month. So 30 patrons is all it would take for us to start getting like a little bit of money. So, and I think at like 10 patrons, we cover our fee. It's only like $63. So we got, you know, 10 patrons, that would, you know, almost completely cover all of our fees. So we know things are hard. There are other ways to donate. Ko-fi, we have a TeePublic store. And if you don't have money, if you can let your friends know about us or just even send us a message and say, we really like your show. Please keep doing this. We love feedback. And you can follow us everywhere on Soaps Podcast. You can follow me, yournewapartment.tumblr.com. I am still on Tumblr.
And you can follow me at Little Gnome Facts on Instagram.
Thanks for listening, you guys.
Thanks for listening.
Peace.
Bye.